Crump. Good evening, Truth Seekers. Mike Malloy here. You got that volume adjusted there, Madam Producer? Jesus, I just about blew my eardrums out. Welcome to the program tonight. This hour is sponsored by Anonymous, but he or she wrote this. Hey, Mike, I listen every night. Usually you get me so worked up, I gin out by hour two. Why do you hate my liver? It's liberal, too. Okay, what we're doing here, we have another sponsor for hour two. We'll mention that one again. Go to MikeMalloy.com, and on the main page, click the sponsor tab up there, and you'll see what this is all about. Okay? So from our this hour sponsor, who shall remain nameless because he or she requested it, I guess, this message. Mike, I listen every night. Usually get me so worked up, I gin out by hour two. Why do you hate my liver? It's liberal, too. I saw this and just had to include it here at the beginning of the program. Is anybody getting tired of being told a product has sea salt in it? Right? Sea salt. Like, what is that? Is that the new blessing from the green goddess or something? Sea salt. What the hell is that? It's salt, right? Last week, Wendy's fast food abattoir, where you go to eat poison, unveiled natural cut sea salt French fries. Now, this is French fries of 100% russet potatoes cut with the skin on, sprinkled with sea salt. Ooh. According to what I have in front of me, in 2010, that's this year, 1,350 new products with sea salt have been introduced. See? I told you. It's everywhere. The percentage of all foods and beverages with sea salt jumped from 5% in 2006 to more than 8% in 2010. A nutritionist with the unlikely name of Marion Nestle, go figure, is unimpressed, saying sea salt tastes the same as table salt, salt costs more, and has the same sodium. Mr. or Ms. Nestle said, the hype for sea salt is amazing. What a hoax. End quote. In Wendy's case here, Wendy's fast food slop joint, the new French fries have more sodium now that they've switched to sea salt. 270 milligrams per small order. It used to be 180. The large order of Wendy's French fries now has 630 milligrams of sodium, up from 460. 630 milligrams of sodium. And people wonder why there's an epidemic of high blood pressure, diabetes, and obesity in this country, huh? Jesus, God. A few items I wanted to get in here before we get to the heavy-duty stuff tonight. The a federal appeals court has upheld a New Hampshire law requiring schools to authorize a time each day for students to voluntarily recite the Pledge of Allegiance. Did you get that sentence? A federal appeals court has upheld a New Hampshire law requiring schools to authorize a time each day for students to voluntarily recite the Pledge of Allegiance, finding that the oath's reference to God does not violate the students' constitutional rights. Now, how can that be? The First Amendment clearly prohibits the state from endorsing religion. And with the Pledge of Allegiance, the state is endorsing religion with under God in it. A three-judge panel of the First Circuit Court of Appeals in Boston Friday affirmed a ruling by a federal judge who found students can use the phrase under God when reciting the pledge Parents in the Freedom From Religion Foundation had sued the Hanover School District in New Hampshire and the Dresden School District in New Hampshire and Vermont in 2007. They said children's constitutional rights were being violated. The appeals court found the primary effect of one nation under God is not the advancement of religion, but the advancement of patriotism. Well, here's a radical idea. Why not, if we're going to have this phony-ass kind of inculcation of patriotism, which it is not. Patriotism comes from believing in the activities of your country, believing that your country is conducting itself in a manner that is advantageous, not just to the citizens of the country, but to the global community. That's what patriotism is. I love my country because it does all these things right, not because I'm forced to say something that pledges allegiance to the flag. It does not pledge allegiance to the country or the Constitution. It's a pledge to a piece of cloth. Oops. I'm sorry. I just get pissed off, Kathy. I mean, why not just recite the original pledge? The original pledge specifically and deliberately did not have the phrase under God slapped in there. That came about, believe it or not, when I was in elementary school. We came back from summer break one year, and we were told that now in addition to standing to say a prayer that the teacher led, we would remain standing and say the pledge, and under God was now in it. What? Under God? What does that mean? It was jammed in there in the mid-50s. As a counterpoint to godless communism. That's why it was put in there. It was put in there by right-wingers. During the Eisenhower administration, I do believe. The original neutral intent of the pledge of unity, liberty, and justice for all has been stripped to add the tyranny of being under the foot of the God law part by the far right. You gotta hate them, don't you? You just gotta hate them. If you're gonna remain sane, you gotta hate them. You gotta just hate them and hate them and hate them. Speaking of how little kids are messed up by this, Molly says the Pledge of Allegiance in her classroom, doesn't she? I think they do. When I went over there the other day to read to the class, yeah, they have a little flag up there where they have the video screen hanging. It's not television, it's video screen. There's a little flag up there. And all the kids, I was sitting in the front of the class getting ready to read. It's called the Dream Program here in Georgia. And parents volunteered to go in and read to the kids, which is kind of cool. I like to do it. That's not Dream? What is it? Oh, DEAR. D-E-A-R? What does it stand for? Huh?
Drop everything and read.
Oh, okay. Drop everything and read. I like that. And the kids in Molly's public school first grade seem just thrilled, as do all the kids in the school. I love this school. I really do. I love this school that Molly attends. But so I was sitting up there. The teacher said, okay, we're about to do the Pledge of Allegiance. Now, all the little children stood up. And I didn't know where to look. You know, I'm looking around. Where do I look to put my hand over my heart and swear a false oath of allegiance? I'm standing in front of six-year-olds. What am I going to do? Am I going to stand there and say, no, don't do this? So I saw a little flag and I stood there. And it was very odd. I have not recited, to the best of my knowledge, I guess I have over the past half century. I was going to say not since I was in elementary school, but I guess that's not the case. But to stand there with 22 sweet, oh no, not this song, 22 sweet little first graders say, one nation under God. We'll be right back. All right, everybody be quiet now. Shh.
From Detroit down to Houston. Thank you.
nightly ammunition against right-wing rhetoric, get locked and loaded with Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour. Dan in Ohio writes, Mike, I'm a lot younger than you. When I was going through Catholic elementary school in the 90s, yeah, I guess you were. Our parents' choice, not mine, Catholic school, we were told at the end that they've added born and unborn to the pledge at the end. One nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice to all, born and unborn. What's next? Dan in Ohio. I guess that was in the Catholic school that he went to. Born and unborn. Oh, well, okay. And again, this hour is sponsored by Anonymous, who says, hey, Mike, I listen every night. Usually you get me so worked up, I gin out by hour two. Why do you hate my liver? It's liberal, too. I don't know, Anonymous. I don't know. Regarding, the hype about sea salt, Roz writes from Canada that maybe sea salt is better because it has more iodine in it. Of course, in the United States, we have iodized salt. That's because everybody in the Midwest were getting these great big neck goiters. Remember that when you were a kid growing up? If you're over a certain age, all the women had goiters. I hated that word, goiter. Ugh. A textbook distributed to Virginia fourth graders says that thousands of African Americans fought for the South during the Civil War. Thousands of African Americans fought for the South during the Civil War. That's a claim that is rejected by historians, but it's often made by groups seeking to play down slavery's role as a cause of the conflict. Kevin Seif, writing the Washington Post, has this story, and once again, and just like One Nation Under God, here we go. The passage that the Post is referring to appears in a book that's being used in Virginia called Our Virginia, Past and Present. It was distributed in that state's public elementary schools for the first time last month. Huh? The author, somebody named Joy Mazoff, it was not a trained historian, said she found the information about black Confederate soldiers primarily through internet research. And practically all of her sources were websites conducted by members of this organization here in the South called Sons of Confederate Veterans. Now, if you're not familiar with these guys, I am. I don't think I've ever met a more humorless bunch of people in my life. These are white guys, all fundamentalist Christian, who claim to be descendants, direct descendants of people who fought in the Civil War. Scholars, the Washington Post says, are nearly unanimous in calling these accounts of black Confederate soldiers a misrepresentation of history. Virginia education officials, after being told by the Washington Post of this issue related to the textbook, said the textbook officials in Virginia, education officials, said that the vetting of the book was flawed and that they will contact school districts across the state to caution them against teaching that particular passage. Don't do that. Don't do that. A spokesman for the State Board of Education, Virginia, Charles Pyle, said, quote, just because the book is approved doesn't mean the Department of Education endorses every sentence. End quote. Well, maybe literally speaking, but if the Department of Education, the state of Virginia, endorses a textbook and one of the teachers decides to leave out parts, I wonder what would happen to that particular teacher. I am sure that there would be screams from the right wing to fire her. The author of this book, going back to Joy Mazoff, M-A-S-O-F-F, she says, as controversial as it is, I stand by what I write. I am a fairly respectable writer. You know what else she's written? She wrote, two titles here. She wrote, Oh Yuck, The Encyclopedia of Everything Nasty, and Oh Yikes, History's Grossest Moments. So she certainly is qualified to write a history of black participation on the side of the Confederacy during the War of Northern Aggression, right? Now, the issue, I want to bring this up because we're about to have a lot of history rewritten with the new Congress coming in January 1st. A lot of things are going to be changed. Omissions and revisions are going to occur because the right wing of this country now feels once again that it is ascendant and it wants to clean up the mess of truth. Truth is a mess to right wingers. It always has been. Right wingers, Republicans in this country, conservatives in this country, teabag freaks, whatever you want to call them, truth is not something they want to deal with. They want to deal with their own particular mythology, which is a polite way of saying lies. So I want to do this when we come back, and it's very quick about what the state of Virginia and this writer, this woman who wrote Oh Yuck, the Encyclopedia of Everything Nasty, and Oh Yikes, History's Grossest Moments, who also wrote Our Virginia, Past and Present. Did you know? Well, we'll talk about it when we come back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
Afraid? Be very afraid. It's Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour. So back to this, a textbook distributed to Virginia fourth graders titled Our Virginia, Past and Present, makes the spurious claim, the factually incorrect claim, that thousands of African Americans laid down their cotton picking bags and marched off to fight with the white Southerners to preserve slavery. That's what this book claims, and the Board of Education of Virginia, when it was pointed out to them that this is garbage, said they will notify the public elementary schools to not to teach that particular part of the book. And again, the issue first came to light after a historian at the College of William and Mary, which is in Virginia, opened her daughter's copy of Our Virginia and saw the reference to black Confederate soldiers. The historian, Carol Sheriff, said, quote, "It's disconcerting that the next generation is being taught history based on an unfounded claim instead of accepted scholarship. It concerns me not just as a professional historian, but as a parent." Yeah, really. Now, Virginia is about ready to mark the 150th anniversary of the beginning of the Civil War. And, yeah, I know, 1861, and here we are coming up on 2011. Ooh, okay. Virginia has long struggled to appropriately commemorate its Confederate past. The debate was reinvigorated, I love that word, this spring when Governor Robert F. McDonnell, a Republican, introduced Confederate History Month of Virginia without mentioning slavery's role in the Civil War. Remember, we talked about this. He later apologized. Now, the Sons of Confederate Veterans is a group of male descendants of Confederate soldiers based in Columbia, Tennessee, and it's long maintained that substantial numbers of black soldiers fought for the South. Think about that for a second. I'm not saying they didn't, but if you were given a choice, you want to be shot dead out in the cotton patch by your white owner, or do you want to go march off and take your chances fighting against the Yankees? What do you want to do, boy? What do you think the choice would have been? The an historian in chief. He's called a historian in chief, kind of like a clavern, clan, claxer, clock, cluker. You know, the KKK has all these titles too for their sad, disturbed members. The Sons of Confederate Veterans has an historian in chief. His name is Charles Kelly Barrow. He's written a book called Black Confederates, and it was this book and other posted on the web and other websites that the woman who wrote the book, Our Virginia Past and Present, got her information. They dispute, the Sons of Confederate Veterans, also one of their primary arguments is the conclusion that the struggle over slavery was the main cause of the Civil War. No, 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 say the Sons of Confederate Veterans. The war was fought, quote, to preserve their homes and livelihood. Yeah, what was their livelihood? Slavery! Jesus, God. Yeah, you were invaded by a foreign army, right? You know, here in the South, it never fails to amaze me. I've been here for over 40 years in the South. A lot of people say, why? I have no answer except I like the countryside. I like the mountains and the lakes and the ocean and the Gulf and yada yada yada. I guess I don't know. I'm just here. But the Sons of Confederate Veterans say that the war was fought, quote, to preserve their homes and livelihood, end quote. And of course, they don't mention that their livelihood had depended on slavery. I'm talking about the wealthy people, just like then, just like now, just like the Gilded Age, just like forever. The wealthy people, this is capitalism in its best, purest, most magical, wonderful form. Slavery! Ow! Right? So, that's what the South was trying to preserve. Their livelihood. Exactly. Slavery. The chief of staff of the Sons of Confederate Veterans, Army of Northern Virginia, oh Christ, said he was pleased that the state, Virginia, a state textbook, accepted some of the views of the Sons of Confederate Veterans. They have an Army of Northern Virginia? Jesus, really? Anyway, when Miss Mazoff began work on the textbook, she said she consulted a variety of sources, history books, experts, and the internet. But when it came to one of the Civil War's most controversial themes, the role of African Americans in the Confederacy, she relied primarily on internet search and the book's publisher, Five Ponds Press in Western Connecticut, sent a Washington Post reporter three of the links Mazoff found on the internet, and each referred to work by the Sons of Confederate Veterans. In its short lesson on the role that whites, African Americans, and Indians played in the Civil War, her book says, quote, thousands of Southern blacks fought in the Confederate ranks, including two black battalions under the command of Stonewall Jackson, end quote. That is not true. Historians across the country said the sentence about Confederate soldiers was wrong. They expressed concerns not only over its accuracy, but over the implication of publishing an assertion so closely linked to revisionist Confederate history. Pulitzer Prize-winning historian James McPherson of Princeton University said, quote, these Confederate heritage groups, Sons of Confederate Veterans, have been making this claim for years as a way of purging their cause of its association with slavery. The claim about Stonewall Jackson is totally false. I don't know where that came from. The book also survived the Virginia Education Department's vetting and was ruled accurate and unbiased by a committee of content specialists and teachers. And now the Department of Education in Virginia said, don't teach that part. Well, I have in front of me here something you may find interesting. The new version of Our Virginia Past and Present will correct a sentence that inaccurately claims that black troops fought under Stonewall Jackson, an assertion historians overwhelmingly say is unproven. this comment. Quote, this is written by someone named Mary Chestnut in 1861. Here's what she wrote. Quote, today I watched our glorious slaves eagerly pick cotton during spare moments between musket reloads as they bravely fought in fresh gray uniforms alongside General Stonewall Jackson, all so happily while under the field foreman's lash and downwind of our wonderfully unprejudiced white troops of the Grand Confederate States of America. The darkies did so to preserve a state's right to sell, whip, and bind the Negro in chains per their proper life station as hard laborers, as mandated by the biblically inspired law of our loving and forgiving Judeo-Christian God of righteousness and good. And, oh yes, Confederate pigs flew out my ass this very day as well. Signed, Mary Chestnut, 1861. I don't know, maybe that's not true either. You think? Oh, God! The lengths to which revisionists will go, it's just like Winston Smith, it's just like the ministry of truth. Who controls the past controls the present. Who controls the present controls the future. And it is so necessary to get control of the past, right? None of this stuff ever happened. There was no slavery. Those are happy people working for Massa so that the cotton would come in. And they were more than happy to pick up the guns and go fight the Yankee invader. Yada, yada, yada. And on and on and on. And teabaggers are really interested in truth, justice, the American way. And Republicans believe in God. According to Huffington Post, MSNBC President Phil Griffin, the new guy, vowed to fire Keith Olbermann if he went on other networks to discuss his suspension. When was it? Last week? A week ago? That's according to Daily Beast's Howard Kurtz. Anything that Howard Kurtz reports, you got to take with a truckload of salt, but let's take the truckload and go on. Kurtz writes that the threat came during a conversation with Michael Price, Keith Olbermann's manager, on November 7th, 2 days into Olbermann's suspension. Price, Olbermann's manager, told Griffin, the head of MSNBC, if the suspension was not resolved quickly, Olbermann would appear on Good Morning America, Larry King Live, and David Letterman's Late Show to air his side of the story. Griffin reportedly replied, if you go on Good Morning America, I will fire Keith. And minutes later, though, Griffin released the statement announcing the lifting of the suspension and preventing an even more serious showdown. There is an effort on right now at MSNBC to get rid of Keith Olbermann. And if he goes, Rachel better be careful. And if she is under threat, then so is Lawrence O'Donnell. Ed Schultz, who'll be around forever. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. Sense out the pasture, drop your IQ, that's what I do. My advice to girls and guys who want to be a Nobel Prize finalist, rocket scientists, try applying this. Keep the customers coming around. If you're smart, then you better start dumbing it down. Don't say anything too profound, dumb it down.
With the truth. It's more Mike Malloy.
Take a long walk through a company town. It is 10 before the hour, and this hour's sponsor, anonymous sponsor, says, hey, Mike, I listen every night. Usually you get me so worked up I gin out by hour two. Why do you hate my liver? I don't know why that makes me laugh. It's liberal, too. Say what? Bruce is his name? Oh, did he email in? Did he? All right, Bruce, thank you for sponsoring the first hour tonight. And we have a sponsor for hour two coming up, but that's hour two. Thanks, Bruce. Arthur in Seattle writes, Mike, I saw the documentary An Inside Job over the weekend. The documentary details the events leading to the collapse of the economy in 2008. The film is excellent and should be required viewing for all Americans. The hijacking of the American economy by legalizing intrinsic criminal policies by the rich and powerful and outright fraud is well documented. However, I'm preaching to the choir concerning your listening audience. The message doesn't seem to be getting out to enough Americans. Maybe the solution is to dumb down the message instead of assuming everyone has taken Economics 101. How about comic books featuring simple and colorful graphics and a superhero named Everyman or Everywoman with the power to produce lasting value for society with hands and minds? Maybe a video game, pie chart. Thanks, Arthur in Seattle. Yeah. I don't care who you are, award-winning filmmaker or emailer or host of a 25-cent radio program like this one, trying to reach the people who continue to vote against their own best economic and issues and issues of real freedom. I don't know how to do that. I really don't. And in fact, I've just given up. I think most people on the left have come to that conclusion. Dan in San Jose, Costa Rica writes, Mike, I was listening to the show tonight on the internet, and I think he's talking about Friday. He says, you and Laura Ingraham made very good points regarding the teabaggers. The fact that they are ridiculous doesn't make them any less dangerous. Laura Ingraham said that? Anyone who underestimates the level of ignorance, irrationality, and malice among Americans doesn't spend much time among them. You two talked about the left losing its momentum. Oh, he's referring to Laura Flanders. Yeah, Dan, I did not have Laura Ingraham on. It was Laura Flanders. I was trying to figure out what Laura Ingraham. She was talking about the same thing. Okay, that changes the email altogether. You and Laura Flanders made very good points regarding the teabaggers. The fact that they are ridiculous doesn't make them any less dangerous. Anyone who underestimates the level of ignorance, irrationality, and malice among Americans doesn't spend much time among them. You two talked about the left losing its momentum, its mojo, and I could go into a lot of reasons why, but that's exactly the problem on the left. We think too much, and we think too deep. If you want to reach more than the thinking 20% of the population, you have to keep it simple. You do a wonderful job of putting fire and emotion into things others discuss in a detached manner, but even emotion goes for naught if it's too complicated for the sixth grade level of thought that passes for average in the country. I don't think the left needs to be as cravenly dishonest as the right, but if we could find a champion who could frame things so that the guy who used to go to the bowling alley before he lost his job could understand, maybe we'd get somewhere. Maybe the sheer volume of the right-wing noise machine would drown anybody out, no matter what the message. Still, I'm grateful to you for your knowledge and passion. Thanks, Dan, San Jose, Costa Rica. I hear that a lot from people who write in, that there's no point in trying to be, first of all, using the kind of humor that you would see Oberman use or Jon Stewart use or Even David Letterman, which is, you know, much broader, much more accessible, that using that kind of humor or using irony or using sarcasm or using whatever form or whatever approach to these issues is lost on the average Republican, the average teabagger, the average conservative, because they don't understand. They simply do not understand political humor. They don't understand political satire. They don't understand nuance or subtlety or irony. It's all, you know, Jesus or the Bible said to do it this way, and queers are bad, and women don't have a right to privacy, and shut up, and I think millionaires or billionaires are wonderful because they've been so good to me. I don't know how to overcome that. The last two emailers here have said, you know, dumb it down. Dumb it down to the point where the average baghead can get it. I can't do that because, Well, that's not my audience. Those people don't listen to me anyway. The only time they pay any attention to this program at all is when one of the monitors, one of these teabag monitor freaks on the right, you know, captures an audio portion of the program and puts it on their website. Ooh, did you hear what Mike Malloy said about Dick Cheney? Ooh, did you hear what Mike Malloy said about ABCD? Ooh. And, you know, I always love it when they do that because then I get the spate of letters from Christians that have F words and GD words and, you know, your children are going to die and your wife's a whore. And it just reinforces to me the absolute idiocy of these baggers. But anyway. All right. We have a break here. Do we not? Is it time? Oh, good. That means I can go to the bathroom, right? Okay. We're going to take a break. We'll be back. We have much more. We've got some Prairie 2. We've got some Kay Petrini. And we also got some Bob Alexander. I think I'm going to try to work in tonight a moment with Bob, a moment with Kay, and a moment with Bruce. Stick around. I'm Mike Malloy. The hour. This hour, sponsored by the American People's Lobby.org. The American People's Lobby.org. And it says here, fighting corporate control of our legislators and buying back our government since 2010. That's this year. It's a new organization. The American People's Lobby.org is a sponsor of this hour of tonight's program. From Lou. Hello, Mike. Haven't written a while. Too angry and disappointed at what I witnessed. What is happening, Mike? Does the corporate and Wall Street cronies finally know how to manipulate the masses without them realizing what is being done to them? So these rich elitists can have their way with our country, our constitution, our middle class values, our way of life, and eliminate and twist them so they can be in firm control? Question mark. Everything is starting to point in that direction with the Supreme Court United, People United decision and corporate contributions into the political process. Things have been bad, and I've been disappointed at some of the direction and stances that the Democrats and Obamas have made, but never disappointed enough to vote those right-wing bastard Republicans in. Now that orange puke John Boehner, Boehner claims he wants to be bipartisan and working out some issues, what a freaking hypocrite, lying blank. When our country was looking for a bipartisan help to solve our most pressing issues, they said no and let Obama sink or swim on his own. Now that they've stirred up the blank to get them elected, they blame it all on the Democrats. They want to cooperate to pass legislation to make them look good for 2012, to say they solved the problems and not the Democrats, so they could finish defeating the Democrats while electing a puking Republican and finish destroying the country. Frankly, Mike, with the vast ignorance and gullibility that was demonstrated in the last election, I'm a little afraid that it could happen. Well, I could go on forever, but I just re-anger and frustrate myself. Take care, Lou. Yeah, I'm reading several emails tonight because I've let some of them back up. I've got one that I really want to share with you, but I think it is time for a prairie too. Missive. Got backed up on those too. Let me take a look at this. Let's do this one. This was from a few days ago. You can read all of his stuff at prairienumeral2.com. But back when Obama was touring through the Far East or Asian countries, Prairie 2 wrote this back on the 11th, it was bad news for President Obama as he emerged from a personal meeting with the president of South Korea without the trade deal he'd been touting all summer as a significant step toward economic recovery. The good news for the U.S. is that he failed to get an update to the 2007 Bush agreement that has not been approved by Congress. The deal was supposed to increase exports of U.S. cars and beef, but even Ford Motor Company was running full-page ads opposing it. The only people in favor of the deal described as the biggest trade deal since NAFTA is the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and they don't represent U.S. businesses. The corporate media is playing up Obama's loss of power to the Republicans as the reason Korea wouldn't make a deal. The reality is that Obama has little to offer the Koreans. The current arrangement allows Korea to sell as many cars in the U.S. as they can make and basically keep U.S. cars out, and they can buy all the beef they want. The real problem for the Koreans is the weakening U.S. dollar and the fact that China continues to tie the renminbi, their currency, to the U.S. currency. The falling Chinese yuan is the big problem since they need to compete with the Koreans. Compete with them. The U.S. doesn't export anything. The problem isn't confined to Korea, of course, with countries that are major trading partners with China, like Brazil, find they are a huge disadvantage. The renminbi has dropped 60% compared to the Brazilian real, and it makes it very difficult for their manufacturers to compete with China, even in Brazil. The World Bank is making no secret of their intention to create a new international currency backed by a large gold component. This would mean the end of the U.S. dollar as the reserve currency of the world, and this might be a good thing, except that some people are pointing out that this could easily lead to the end of U.S. sovereignty. The reason for this is that we are completely dependent on imports for our very existence, and without the ability to create our own money, we will become serfs to the people who do control the money. Currently, we are at least peasants with some rights. Serfs have none. And without a sovereign currency, we would only sink ever lower. The folks in control of the Deficit Commission are the very people who have no problem with the loss of U.S. sovereignty since they see themselves as potential feudal barons. It's time for Obama to show some spine if he wants to be anything but a novelty footnote in U.S. history. Perhaps it was a deliberate strategy that he didn't give Korea what they wanted, whatever that was. Obama has hinted ever since he created the Deficit Commission that he was calling the bluff of the so-called deficit hawks by doing so. This could explain loading the commission with all the right-wing crazies who really believe in drowning government in the bathtub. The American people may be forced to face reality before it's too late to stop the Republicans after all. Prairie2.com. Yeah, I am astonished by Obama's performance, partly because of my deliberate misperception of what he's about. You know, like a lot of people, a lot of liberals in this country, I thought Obama was going to do something that could be considered liberal or progressive, not knowing that, because I didn't do my homework, I guess, that Obama's agenda is as corporatist as Hillary Clinton's was, or as Bill Clinton's, or as any other Republican who's ever served in office, with the exception of George Bush. George Bush was not a corporatist. He was an idiot, just a class A idiot. But I didn't do my research, like a lot of people did not. And we got Barack Obama. But for the teabaggers and the right-wing fools in this country to refer to him as a socialist never fails to amaze me. another example of how Glenn Beck or Rush Limbaugh or the Fox Channel or whoever, they gather up all this garbage that their writers can come up with, and they pre-digest it, and then they funnel it out over radio and television, and the brain-dead Republicans and right-wingers and teabaggers suck it up, just like somebody getting a glucose drip when they're in the hospital having their brain removed, which is what these Republicans are doing. So what is being absorbed is the swill put out there by the right-wing media that is absolutely not true. Obama is no more of a liberal than your mama is. You know what I'm saying? Was your mama a liberal? No, I don't think so. Your mama was a dictator, wasn't she? Huh? There was no democracy when you were a kid growing up. Mama was a dictator. Obama is not a liberal. He never has been. He never will be. But these dumb-ass Republicans continue to tell each other, oh, he's a liberal, he's a socialist, he's a communist, he's from Kenya, he's not an American, woo! All because the man is black. That's it. What else? Coming up third hour, I'm going to talk a little bit about this, the pissant, George Bush. By the way, Mike in Chicago writes, Mike, when Bush says, quote, everyone was in agreement about Saddam having weapons of mass destruction, end quote, would you please explain who Scott Ritter is to your audience? Hopefully, his book contract requires him flying out of the country and having to go visit Spain. Isn't it a sad commentary when you have to depend on other countries to take care of our justice system? He's referring to Bush going over there and getting arrested, of course, and tried for war crimes. Yeah, Scott Ritter, who is a Marine Corps Marine Corps veteran, a captain, who was also a UN weapons inspector. And Scott Ritter tried to tell the world that there were no weapons of mass destruction anywhere in Iraq. So when George Bush says everyone agreed that there were, he's a goddamn liar. That's all. And this whorish media that backed him up are also goddamn liars. We'll be right back. Put your good sense out the pasture. Drop your IQ. That's what I do. My advice to girls and guys who want to be a Nobel Prize finalist. Rocket scientists, try applying this. Keep the customers coming around. If you're smart, then you better start dumbing it down. Don't say anything too profound. Dumb it down.
Synchronized screaming. It's Mike Malloy.
There was a tragedy in Shanghai. I'm sure you saw it on the news today. Earlier today, the death toll stood at 42. Although it's expected to go much higher, it was a huge fire that ravaged an apartment building in downtown Shanghai. Helicopters were trying to get to people, but the smoke and flames prevented the rescue of victims that were screaming for help from the roof before they burned to death or jumped. The AP says desperate residents jumped from the building's windows as flames engulfed them. China's Xinhua news agency reported the 30-story structure was being renovated when its scaffolding caught fire. Flames quickly spread across more than a third of the building. TV footage shows the blackened building completely engulfed in flames as terrified onlookers huddled several blocks away. Rescue helicopters were unable to land. 100 injured, some expected to die. Smoke inhalation. CNN reports. Al Jazeera reports. Bloomberg News reports. Shanghai Daily reports. China's Xinhua news agency reports. And I saw the video on both MSNBC and CNN, and I couldn't help but think, I apologize not to you, but to somebody. I apologize for having this thought, but the thought still presented itself in the middle of that tragedy. The building did not collapse. And yet we are to believe that the Twin Trade Towers did collapse because of fires that were contained on the upper floors. We're supposed to believe that. That's the official story. That these monster buildings in Lower Manhattan had a fire. A plane. Sure, it was a plane. But they don't say the plane knocked the building off its foundation, otherwise the building would have tipped over. The building fell into its own footprint. And why did the buildings fall into its own footprint? Well, the official story is because the flames weakened everything hundreds and hundreds of yards below, so the thing collapsed. And yet here's this horrendous fire engulfing this building in Shanghai, people dead, people screaming, people jumping, and the building didn't collapse. Astonishing that the only known, let me rephrase that, that the only buildings I know of, big buildings that collapsed into their own footprint as a result of a fire, were on September 11, 2001 in Lower Manhattan. Jenny Thomas, the wife of Supreme Court Justice Clarence, Uncle Clarence Thomas, is stepping down as president and CEO of Liberty Central, the Tea Party affiliated think tank she founded, according to the Washington Post. Liberty Central spokesperson Caitlin Carroll told the Washington Post Amy Gardner that Ginny was relinquishing control of the organization to spare the organization the, quote, distractions caused by her celebrity. Ooh, the Post reports it this way, quote, she'll take a back seat so that Liberty Central can continue with its mission without any of the distractions. After discussing it with the board, Mrs. Thomas determined that it was best for the organization, end quote. Of course, the major distraction is one that Jenny Thomas created herself, and that was the phone call to Anita Hill to suggest that Ms. Hill apologize to Uncle Clarence, because Uncle Clarence was a sexist son of a bitch that tried to convince Anita Hill to drop her drawers back when they worked together at the Office of Economic Opportunity or someplace. Alternet has reported links between Liberty Central and several far-right outfits. Gun Owners of America, headed by militia guru Larry Pratt, known for addressing a gathering of white supremacist groups in the 1990s, is associated with Liberty Central. The Missouri Sovereignty Project, whose website features a video threatening armed insurrection against the government. Traditional Family and Property, a religious cult that celebrates the Spanish Inquisition and trains teenage recruits in medieval warfare with spears and maces. These are all connected to Ginny's little Liberty Central. Eh? And therefore to Uncle Clarence. And therefore to Uncle Clarence's decisions on the U.S. Supreme Court. Also, the Patrick Henry Center Advisory Board. Includes talk show host Mark Levin, who is a right-wing freak. Oliver North, who was convicted of a felony in the Iran-Contra scandal, a verdict that was later tossed out on a technicality. Beverly LaHaye is on the Patrick Henry Advisory Board, founder of the Concerned Women for America. It just goes on and on. So Ginny, Uncle Clarence's old lady, is stepping down so she can go do something else, I guess. Baby, you're lost. Baby, you're lost. Mike Malloy program is sponsored by the AmericanPeople'sLobby.org. The AmericanPeople'sLobby.org. Fighting corporate control of our legislators and buying back our government since 2010. Check them out. I've been to their website, TheAmericanPeople'sLobby.org. And thanks, folks, for doing that. If you want to be a sponsor of an hour of this program, you can do so very simply. Go to MikeMalloy.com, and there's a tab up there, a sponsor page. Click. I think it's time for another moment with Bob, I believe. Do we have the ukulele music? What's that? Another moment with Bob, brought to you by your friends at Offshore Drilling. Tonight's episode entitled Time to Get Out the Map. Hey, Mike, it drives me slightly crazy every time I listen to Amy Goodman, Tom Hartman, or any other reasonable voice from the left. It also happens when I read Paul Krugman, Matt Taibbi, or even Noam Chomsky. It's not what they say. It's what they leave out. It seems almost everybody on the left is playing a nationwide game of let's pretend. It's starting to get on my nerves. It makes me want to say, let's play a game. Instead of calling it let's pretend, we'll call it let's not pretend. Let's stop pretending we don't know what we know. And then do something. Here's where we started. Here's what we know. 10 years ago, the Supreme Court of the United States invalidated the presidential election process and installed George W. Bush as president. 2 years later, voter suppression and rigged voting machines gave the Republican Party majorities in the House and Senate. 2 years after that, voter suppression and rigged voting machines stole the presidential election again. If we truly believe the Constitution of the United States of America is the supreme law of the land, instead of, as Bush would call it, a goddamn piece of paper, we would act differently. We're not supposed to pretend that we have had a legitimate form of government for the last 10 years. We're not supposed to pretend that the criminal policies of the Bush crime family magically stopped the moment Barack Obama stepped into the Oval Office. What did the Bush crime syndicate do after it seized control of the country? They started two wars of aggression, killed over 1 million people, legitimized torture and murder, and engineered the largest transfer of wealth in history from poor and middle-class Americans to the richest people in the country. Barack Obama and his administration have done absolutely nothing to hold anyone in the previous administration accountable for anything. We know that our military has tortured innocent people to death. It's been in all the papers and documentaries that have been made alerting us to these facts. Regardless of anything Obama has ever said about withdrawing from Iraq and Afghanistan, the truth looks something like this. There have been no reports of any dismantling or plans to dismantle the 5 so-called enduring bases in Iraq, and there's an ongoing effort to expand the already record-breaking embassy in that country to accommodate the additional hundreds of administrators above the original 1,000 projected U.S. officials there. And last summer, the New York Times reported, quote, the United States has discovered nearly $1 trillion in untapped mineral deposits in Afghanistan, far beyond any previously known reserves, and enough to fundamentally alter the Afghan economy and perhaps the Afghan war itself, according to senior American government officials. The previously unknown deposits are so big and includes so many minerals that are essential to modern industry, that Afghanistan could eventually be transformed into one of the most important mining centers in the world, the United States officials believe, end quote. With that kind of money still on the table, I don't think we'll be packing our bags in Afghanistan anytime soon. Barack Obama and the majority of Democrats have continued every single hideous policy initiated by the Bush regime. When it came to keeping both wars on track and finishing the biggest financial ripoff in history, Obama bowed to the corporatocracy's will. It makes no difference whatsoever if Obama went along with this because a gun was pointed to his head or if he willfully joined in. The end result is the same. The gang that took power 10 years ago is still calling the shots. It is not like fascism. It is fascism. There's no need to try to find the appropriate simile. We've made it. We've arrived. We have to stop pretending we can negotiate with the criminal regime that rules this country. We have to stop pretending that protesting against the junta is a viable option. 42 years ago, anti-war protesters saw a glimmer of the power of the state at the Democratic Convention in Chicago. 18 months later, in Ohio, students were killed. The state plays for keeps. We have to stop pretending that they don't. There is no solution. We either leave or adapt. The two big differences between Nazi Germany and present-day America are these. The Nazis ran death camps in-house, you might say. Our torture camps, our secret U.S. prisons, on the other hand, are spread out around the globe. According to the Red Cross, the regime at Guantanamo causes psychological suffering that has driven inmates mad with scores of suicide attempts, with three inmates killing themselves in 2006. The Allied forces in World War II stopped the Nazi regime by reducing German cities to rubble. The rest of the world has not united to stop the U.S. yet. Ever since it was obvious that there was going to be a black man in the White House, the mainstream media has tolerated and never exposed the outrageous lies and scare tactics of Fox Channel. Fox Channel hosts regularly demonize and foment violence against anyone or anything progressive. They place the blame for the problems that beset this country on liberals. Glenn Beck has clearly told his followers who the enemy is. Us. In January 2010, public policy polling reported that the Fox Channel was the most trusted television news channel in the country. Every television and radio news program broadcast since December 12, 2000, and in every newspaper published since that date, should have been begun with a recap of how the Supreme Court illegally placed George W. Bush in the presidency and demanded the impeachment of Justices Kennedy, O'Connor, Rehnquist, Scalia, and Thomas, as well as the speedy removal from office of George Bush and his entire administration. But that didn't happen. Now we have got to stop pretending a criminal organization didn't take over the country. And then leave. We can't fight them. They've got all the guns. They own the electoral process. We lost. I've read that some Jews didn't leave Germany because they owned pianos. We should learn from that and get rid of everything we don't need on eBay. The next Civil War will be everywhere. Regards, Bob Alexander. You can go to Bob's website, Super Beans. That's right, superbeans.com. You may find a link there to go to his essays. Another moment with Bob brought to you by your friends at Offshore Drilling. But this hour is sponsored by the AmericanPeople'sLobby.org, fighting corporate control of our legislators and buying back our government since 2010. What else we got here? Yeah, next hour, some more stuff about George W. Bush and his half-witted book. I am so. Oh well, never mind. Oh, and also, how do you know when your country has the perception of your country has changed among the other industrialized countries of the world, where your country, this one, is starting to take on the gloss, the shine of a so-called third world country. Now, I think we invented that term, third world country, in our arrogance and our determination to exploit anybody and everybody. But that term, third world country, since it's in the vernacular now, okay, how can you tell when your country is starting to take on third world status in the eyes of the rest of the industrialized nations? I'm going to answer that for you next hour. I am. We got a break here? We do. We'll take a break and come back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
It's Mike Malloy.
10 before the hour, from Kay Petrini, our education correspondent. Hi, Mike. In U.S. history, we're wrapping up our unit on the Constitution. She's a school teacher, as you know. And to bring the Bill of Rights to life, especially the Second Amendment, we are watching Michael Moore's film Bowling for Columbine. This year, I decided to adapt one of the lessons from the film's resource packet for my classes. As I read over the words of Martin Luther King Jr., the seriousness of what happened this past Tuesday hit me like a ton of bricks in reference to the election. Martin Luther King Jr.'s speech on Vietnam, excerpt, April 4th, 1967, quote, "Somehow this madness must cease. We must stop now. I speak as a child of God and brother to the suffering poor of Vietnam. I speak for those whose land is being laid waste, whose homes are being destroyed, whose culture is being subverted. I speak for the poor of America who are paying the double price of smashed hopes at home and death and corruption in Vietnam. I speak as a citizen of the world, for the world as it stands aghast at the path we have taken. I speak as an American to the leaders of my own nation. The great initiative in this war is ours. The initiative to stop it must be ours. I am convinced that if we are to get on the right side of the world revolution, we as a nation must undergo a radical revolution of values. We must rapidly begin to shift from a thing-oriented society to a person-oriented society. When machines and computers, profit motives, and property rights are considered more important than people, the giant triplets of racism, materialism, and militarism are incapable of being conquered. These are revolutionary times. All over the globe, men and women are revolting against old systems of exploitation and oppression. And out of the womb of a frail world, new systems of justice and equality are being born. The shirtless and barefoot people of the land are rising up as never before. The people who sat in darkness have seen a great light," quote unquote. We in the West must support these revolutions. It is a sad fact that because of conflict, complacency, a morbid fear of communism, and our proneness to adjust to injustice, the Western nations that initiated so much of the revolutionary spirit of the modern world have now become the arch anti-revolutionaries. Our only hope today lies in our ability to recapture the revolutionary spirit and go out into a sometimes hostile world, declaring our eternal hostility to poverty, racism, and militarism. A genuine revolution of values means, in the final analysis, that our loyalties must become ecumenical rather than sectional. Every nation must now develop an overriding loyalty to mankind as a whole in order to preserve the best in their individual societies. And then Kay added in her instructions to her class, Dr. King says that the war in Vietnam is but a symptom of a far deeper illness within the American spirit. He speaks specifically of, quote, the giant triplets of racism, materialism, and militarism, end quote. Your assignment, you will work in groups of four. Using your note chart, brainstorm examples of racism, materialism, and militarism at work in the film Bowling for Columbine. Then discuss with your group members, one, in what ways are these forces at work in today's America, and two, what kind of impact do you think they have on the level of violence in this country? Your task, then, design a poster that reflects your views on the connection between the giant triplets and violence in America today. Shortly after this, as a matter of fact, about a year later, the government of the United States had Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. assassinated. He was no longer just your friendly Negro preacher. He was speaking in terms of revolution against what? Against capitalism and the exploitation of people, not in, just in this country, but using the war in Vietnam as a framework, the exploitation, the death, the destruction, the thievery, the lies, the deceit being perpetrated on that tiny country. For what? Again, I would ask any right-winger to tell me what was accomplished other than the wall in Washington, D.C., with the names of 58,000 dead Americans and the statistical horror of approximately 3 million dead Indochinese. Tell me, right-winger, what was accomplished by that war? Oh, I realize it was a long, long time ago, wasn't it? And history in this country is what happened yesterday. And what happened last week is totally forgotten. Something that occurred 45 years ago? You've got to be kidding me, right? 45 years ago? Damn! Come on, Malloy, get in the present. Just keep that in mind, that a year after changing from the radical Negro preacher. Yeah, he was a little bit radical, but nothing that the American capitalist system couldn't absorb and nullify, compromise. Once it was realized that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. could not be neutralized by the establishment in this country. In fact, he was becoming more radicalized and asking his followers or people who listened to him to become more radicalized. Then it became necessary to do what is always necessary when fascism is making its move to take over, when corporatism is making its move to take over, when capitalism realizes that there's somebody with a large following out there who's speaking against them. He had to be murdered, and he was. Stick around. Third hour coming up after the break. I'm Mike Malloy. Okay, have you tried the sponsor idea? You know, we just started it tonight. Go to MikeMalloy.com, click the sponsor tab. Isn't this fun? Huh? You get to sponsor an hour of this program. A couple of things I wanted to bring up this hour. Do you, what would constitute proof that the United States is becoming, or concerns our labor force, a so-called third world country in the eyes of the rest of the industrialized world? What would it take? What would be the one thing that would indicate to you that other capitalists in other countries are seeing us as a third world country? To me, it would be labor cost. Now, remember, labor cost is the one thing that the capitalists would like to get rid of. The huge fortunes in assets, land, all sorts of at the time, technology, believe it or not, that were built in this country in the 19th century, came to greater or lesser degrees, depending on where you lived, to a large extent on slave labor. That's one of the reasons that there are and have always been so few black millionaires in this country, or black families of great wealth, as there are white families of great wealth. Capitalism favors those people who can figure out ways to make enormous profits with literally, you know, as little expenditure as possible. Duh. I mean, that's pretty elementary. But the one cost that is difficult to control unless you live in a society that determines, you know, who will serve and who will eat, as I think Roger Waters wrote that, is labor costs. So one of the reasons, one of the big driving forces that got companies out of the United States, the capitalists, the corporations, to move, of course, is labor costs. NAFTA did that. The General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs, GATT, International Monetary Fund, all this so-called neoliberal school of economics that says move your, it says in part, first of all, create free trade, which is nonsense. The people that say freedom isn't free, free trade isn't free either. Fair trade, the fair trade idea was much better. Universal rules were concerned environment and labor costs. But no, nobody wanted to do that. Of course not. The capitalists who dictate the terms of these sea change events, I believe that's the expression, like globalization, they determine what the rules are going to be, not the people who understand the needs of human beings, whether they live in Namibia or Alabama. It doesn't really make any difference, right? Does it? The cultural differences maybe, but the essential needs are there. So, labor costs. Oh, the capitalists would love to live in a society that maintains slavery. Feed the bastards, work them to death, kick them into a common grave, move on. That's how you make big intergenerational piles of money. They go on forever and ever and ever. And it doesn't have to be strictly slavery. It can be some of the big industrial factories of the North in this country during the 18th and 19th centuries, where labor was unorganized, and therefore kids, you know, 7-year-olds, 6-year-olds, 5-year-olds would be put to work. Women could be locked in at their sewing machines. The shirtwaist fire, remember that one? How many scores, dozens, hundreds of women's burned to death because the capitalists had locked them in? And then along came Samuel Gompers, who I believe was the first union organizer in the United States, organized what, the cigar rollers? Is that what it was, Kathy? The people that manufacture cigars? So anyway, labor. That's the one thing the capitalists hate. Those damn, boy, if we could just figure out a way to eliminate labor costs. Well, the quickest way in this country is to move, or was, 20 years ago, when the idea was really moving forward, get the jobs out of the United States. You realize what we're paying auto workers and people work in the manufacturing industry, people that make air conditioners and refrigerators and furniture and textiles and gizmos and doodads and jujaws and gimcracks. Do you realize what we're paying? Get the jobs, get the factories out of the United States. The Republicans went to work on that, and Bill Clinton, being a typical corporatist Democrat, went along with it, signed the bill.
Well, I had to sign it because they had a veto-proof Congress on me back there in 97. I had to sign it. And besides, there was some talk they were going to impeach me. So I figured if I signed, NAFTA, they'd leave me alone. Same thing applied to, ending, the bill that, or the law that kept investment banks and depository banks separate, you know, Glass-Steagall, I think they called it. Well, I tried.
Clinton did that. He signed off on this stuff. So the jobs went first to Mexico.
Yeah, it's going to be a wonderful thing for American worker. We're an American consumer. We're going to get products back from Mexico. It's going to be dirt cheap.
Remember that? Remember the only person said, don't do it, was Ross Perot. Remember that? His giant sucking sound statement. And everybody laughed their asses off, right? Oh, okay, Ross, right, you're right. The giant sucking sound caused by the air rushing into the vacuum that was created when all the jobs left the United States. You follow me? You still with me? Good. So the jobs went to Mexico. And then they started moving overseas. Remember back in the day, you're probably too young, but back in the day, made in Japan meant junk. Made in China then meant junk. Made in Mexico meant junk. Compared to what was being produced in this country by American workers, the American middle class, the American labor force, unionized, working, hardcore Americans, right? Good job, solidly working class, middle class, whatever. Go to church on Sunday. Okay, maybe a synagogue. Civic clubs, union meeting halls, bowling on Wednesday night. Well, not Wednesday night, Tuesday night. Wednesday night was prayer meeting. But all those things, remember? And it was all based on one thing. People had jobs. Work, income, homes, plans, a future. And, of course, all that changed. You follow me? Sit with me? So what constitutes an identifier that says your country is becoming third world, so-called? I mean, that's our term, third world. That's how we label other people. But stipulating that term is classist, racist, sexist, and every ist you can think of, even capitalist. Let's use it for just a second anyway. Third world. What is a clear indication that your country is becoming third world in the eyes of what used to be your competitors? Other industrialized nations around the planet. You want a second? All right, let's do a break. You think about it. When we come back, I give you my opinion. Stay with us, all right? I'm Mike Malloy. Live on faith, live on hope. High on Jesus, your hook don't go. When it's way too late to just say no, you can't make it here anymore. Like the one.
him dangerous. It's Mike Malone.
One past the hour. Okay, have you come up with an answer? What is one of the primary indicators that your country is being handed third world status by other industrialized nations, as we have done so often to other countries around around the planet? Now it's being done to us. Well, let me just give you the backstory here. In Greer, South Carolina, the German automaker BMW put out a call recently to hire 1,000 factory workers in Greer. That is like just unheard of. And Greer, South Carolina, is not a big city. As a matter of fact, I wouldn't even give it city status. It's a large town, perhaps. Anyway, the people who responded reflect the upheaval in our economy. And in ways beyond the most obvious. According to the Washington Post, among the applicants, a former manager of a major distribution center for Target, a consultant who oversaw construction projects in 4 Western states, a supervisor at a plastics recycling firm. Some of the people held college degrees in other fields where they made more money, but they were all lined up to apply for jobs at the factory, and a lot of them got hired. They are now making $15 an hour at BMW in Greer, South Carolina. $15 an hour is half what the typical German auto worker makes. So BMW, and there's your answer. When all of a sudden BMW or some other country, a company, looks around and says, okay, we want to open an auto plant, but we got to get it out of Germany because, geez, we pay our people $30 an hour. Does this sound familiar? Mm-hmm. Where can we go? Well, we can't go to Japan. That's real. Get real. Can't go to Mexico. That country is becoming a narco state before the world's very eyes. Anybody who would open a business in Mexico is insane. So what do we do? The Canadians would laugh at us if we tried to come there because they have a stable economy. I know! The United States! Where they have all these unemployed former auto workers who used to make $35 an hour making cars. Yeah, members of unions had great retirement, insurance, 401ks, blah, 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 whatever. And now, do you know the effective unemployment rate over there in the United States is about 18%? Oh, yeah, their government keeps telling us 9.5 or 9.4 or 9 point whatever, 9 point. Like somebody's going to be, oh, it's 9.4. Well, last week it was 9.5. Yay! We're coming down! We're coming down! Let's go to the United States. We can get labor there real cheap. We don't have to worry about unions. Oh, my God, you forget that. And we'll locate someplace where they're desperate for work, just desperate. Hell, we can probably find a place where we can get college graduates. Ah, how's that? Can you imagine a college graduate here in Germany working in auto? No, I can't either. But in the United States, high school graduates, yeah, get them all, roll them in. Come on, boys. Come on, girls. Let's go. We're going to pay you. Well, actually, it's not $15 an hour. We have a two-tiered system now. You start out at $11 an hour. And if you are good little slave, I'm sorry, if you're good little workers, we'll take you up to 13 and then 14 and then $15 an hour. How's that? Does that make your little hearts happy? Huh? How about that $15 an hour? Woo! In a 40-hour week, that's $600 a week. Can you say $600 a week? That's $30,000 a year. How about that? Huh? Pretty soon you'll be able to afford a house. You'll never be able to afford a BMW, but that's not the point. We're not Henry Ford, where we decided to pay you wages so that you could buy a BMW. Are you serious? This is for people much better off than you are. But you folks in Greer, South Carolina, have we got a deal for you. Oh, by the way, so you don't feel like we are taking advantage of your labor force, we know that GM and Chrysler now only pay $14, $15 an hour for their new hires, too. Ba-bum, ba-bum, bum, bum, which is about half of what their existing workers take home. So we here at BMW in Germany are only jumping on the bandwagon started by the capitalists in the United States. We love you, workers. We think you're great. We love you!
Saw the boss come walking down along the factory line, saying, boys, we have to tighten up our belts. But he didn't look any thinner than he did a year ago, and I wonder just how hungry that man felt. He knows it ain't hard to get along with somebody else's troubles. They don't make him lose any sleep at night. Fate is out there busting somebody else's bubbles. Everything is gone.
You're listening to Resistance Radio with Mike Malloy.
Before the hour, over the weekend, MSNBC played the full interview of George W. Bush, conducted by Matt Lauer, an hour-long interview. It was one of the damnedest things I've ever seen in my life. Watching Bush, the same frat boy, kiss-my-ass kind of body language that he's so famous for, backed up by nothing. There's no there. All hat, no cattle, whatever. Every time I hear that expression or anything from the Bush era, it gives me stomach spasms. The damage that those two bastards, those two outlaws did to this country is incalculable this close to the 8 years that they were in power. It's going to take a while for historians to take a look at the damage that they did. Just like it took a while for the historians to take a look at the good that FDR did. But the damage is, one thing most people can agree upon, it is incalculable, whether you're looking at it from a dollars and cents standpoint or America's reputation standpoint or U.S. foreign policy standpoint or regulatory agencies controlling predatory capitalism standpoint. Banking industry becoming nothing more than gambling dens. Whatever level you want to look at the 8 years of the Bush crime family, it's shocking what they did to this country. Unbelievably so. Cheney's not long for this earth. The life is being sucked out of him even as we speak. But George W. Bush, it's probably going to be around for a while unless he, you know, falls off his bicycle or, you know, cuts off a leg and bleeds to death when he's doing his brush clearing out in Prairie Chapel. Remember that little sacrosanct mud spot, huh? Anyway, watching George W. Bush on MSNBC, I think it was Sunday, damn near ruined the day. But it was fascinating. It's like watching one of those programs on the Nature Channel, where one of the Nature Channels, whether it's Nat Geo or whatever, you know, where hungry animals stalk other animals, and they usually go, the hungry animals will, given a choice, go for the lame or the old or the babies. Those are the ones that they will stalk and kill. The predators go for those first because they're easier to catch, easier to destroy. And it just, you know, watching Bush talking with Matt Lauer reminded me of one of those creepy, and I realize the predators are just doing what they're supposed to do, what nature dictates that they will do. You know, some leopard or cheetah slinking through the tall grass and spots a baby wildebeest, and you know that baby wildebeest is soon going to be munched on. And there won't be anything left after the hyenas get through with the corpse. But Bush reminded me of one of those jungle beasts. Sitting there, smacking his lips and looking around the room and fidgeting and twisting. When somebody as a simpleton like Matt Lauer sits there and asks him softball questions, and the questions that I'm sure Matt Lauer's producer said, Matt, this is a tough question. Now, when you ask this one, stick out that upper lip like you do sometimes when you're coming on with your tough question, just to put Mr. President on notice. Okay, Matt. And I'm sure Matt looked at the question, oh, I can do that. Can't you think of, just off the top of your head, about 20 people that you think would be more effective inquisitors where it concerns George Bush than Matt Lauer? But I digress. Matt Lauer is just doing what he has paid millions upon millions of dollars to do, and that's to help people forget. So, but there he was talking with George W. Bush. And the attitude of Bush, he still has that, I can answer your question before you even put the punctuation at the end of it, kind of thing, that lying politicians, you know, a politician is a liar, a goddamn liar, when they do that. So, Mr. Bush, what made you decide to go into Iraq? Well, I knew I had to go because Jesus told me. Boom, you know, right away, before you know if it's a period, a colon, a semicolon, question mark, exclamation, it doesn't make any difference. There he is with his answer. Huh? Like McCain in debates. Like any presidential candidate, Democrat or Republican, any candidates for him, Democrat or Republican, they always do that. So what do you think of global poverty? I'm against it! You know, before they even get the question out. That is supposed to show the viewer, look how on top of everything I am! Woo-woo! I don't even have to think! I am so packed full of policy ideas. But George W. Bush, he does it because he's a goddamn coward. And he knows he's stupid. It must be awful to know you're stupid. I know that I'm ignorant about a lot of things, but I'm not stupid. George Bush is stupid. And I think his mother told him that over and over and over again. You're stupid. Sit down. We want Jeb to be. Sit down. Shut up. Mama, have a drink. Sit down. His old lady was hell on him. Oh, my God. There he is with Matt Lauer. I digress again. There he is with Matt Lauer. Answering questions as though he had a firm grasp of the implications of his answer, which he did not. But guess what? There is a move afoot. U.S. activists, inspired by a British campaign against Tony Blair's book, another war criminal, Tony Blair. But the Brits all have to take care of their own. The way we take care of ours in this country, we pay them enormous amounts of money. We let them build presidential libraries. We give them things. Subsequent presidents say, oh, I'm not going to prosecute. I'm going to look forward, not back. So the Brits all have to deal with Tony Blair in whatever manner they see fit. But the people in the UK decided to work a campaign against Tony Blair's books. And what they do, they go to a bookstore where Blair's biography is featured. And they move. I think his book was called A Journey. And whenever the activists in the UK see Tony Blair's book, A Journey, they move it to the crime section, or the horror section, or even the fantasy section of the bookstore in UK bookshops. Now, there's a campaign urging people to do the same. The campaign is titled Move Bush's Book to Where It Belongs. And the idea is to move his book to the true crime section, which I will damn sure definitely do the next time I visit Borders, which I don't like. I hate to do that to my friendly neighborhood local bookstore or bookseller, but maybe she will already have moved it into the crime section. I don't know. But I will damn sure do it at Borders. Borders pisses me off. The only thing I like about Borders is they have good coffee. I guess I'm now somebody's going to email me and say, well, you don't understand. Borders is a real blue company. Really? Well, I don't know anything about that. On top of everything else, now it turns out, according to the Guardian of the UK, Bush has been accused of borrowing from other books in his memoirs. Borrowing? If Clinton were to do that, wouldn't it be called plagiarism? Borrowing? The UK, Guardian of the UK says, it now appears that Decision Points, George Bush's book, is not so much the former president's memoirs as other people's cut and pasted memories. Oh! Quoting the Huffington Post, which noted a remarkable similarity between previously published writings and Bush's colorful anecdotes from events at which he had not been present. Bush browsed heavily from Bob Woodward's account, Bush at War, which the White House criticized as inaccurate when it was published in 2002. Bush also appears to take chunks from a book written by his former press secretary, Ari Fleischer. Want a couple examples? Okay, we got to do a break, right? We got a break coming here. Bush recounts a meeting between Harbin Karzai and a Tajik warlord on the Afghan president's inauguration day, Karzai's inauguration day, which he used as an example, Bush did, of hope for the future of the country. The former president writes, quote, when Karzai arrived in Kabul for his inauguration on 22 December, 102 days after 9/11, several Northern Alliance leaders and their bodyguards greeted him at an airport. As Karzai walked across the tarmac alone, a stunned Tajik warlord asked where all his men were. Karzai responded, why, General, you are my men. All of you who are Afghans are my men. End quote. Now, that's from Bush's book. The Huffington Post notes that the account and the quote are lifted almost verbatim and without attribution from the New York Review of Books article by Ahmed Rashid. Verbatim. Bush wasn't there. Bush also lifts a quote from an interview John McCain gave the Washington Post on Iraq and then presents it as though McCain had said it to him. There's more. Stick around.
Mike Malone.
10 before the hour. So, it appears that George W. Bush, whoever wrote the book for him, used the old cut-and-paste method constitutes plagiarism, of course. The Guardian of the UK refers to it as borrowing from other books. Bush has been accused of borrowing from other books in his memoirs. Now, let's assume that the Guardian of UK is using that famous or infamous British sense of humor there. Borrowing. No, there's a word for it. Plagiarizing is the word. Anyway, The Huffington Post notes that the account of Hamid Karzai talking to one of his Northern Alliance general, that entire conversation that Bush writes about as if he were there. Of course, Bush wasn't there, but the person who was there is a writer named Ahmed Rashid, who had this in an article he wrote for the New York Review of Books. But you see, when you're a member of the Bush crime family, stealing lines from some other writer and attributing them or without attribution, putting them in your own book means nothing. I mean, come on. This is a guy who ordered the deaths of thousands of people, children, babies, fetuses, semen, eggs inside the uteruses of women. I mean, that's what right wingers are worried about, right? They're worried about that microscopic life. Think of all the millions, tens of millions, uncountable hundreds of millions of people George Bush murdered because of all those men who died with unexpired semen. You see how that works, right? Okay. Bush also lists a quote from an interview John McCain gave to the Washington Post on Iraq and then presents it as though McCain said it to him, to Bush, even though McCain was talking to a reporter for the Washington Post. And according to The Guardian UK, even when where Bush is present and is quoting himself, he appears to have had his memory jogged by the accounts of others without finding much to add. Well, of course not. He's a dry drunk. Remember how George Bush got off liquor? Well, I just stopped. I stopped drinking. I woke up one morning, I was just covered in vomit and, you know, messed my paints and everything. And Mom said to me, "You better stop drinking, boy." And I just quit. Yeah. Many of the borrowed lines, The Guardian, the UK, says, why not plagiarized? Many of the borrowed lines are taken from Bob Woodward's book, Bush at War, with the former war criminal, or the current war criminal's, accounts of meetings bearing a striking similarity to Woodward's. Bush's publisher has suggested that only confirms the accuracy of decision points. Oh, others have suggested all this is a reflection of two traits Mr. Bush was often criticized for: lack of original thought and laziness. I never criticized him for that. I criticized him for being a goddamn murderer, a killer, a disrespecter of international law, a world-class criminal. Laziness? Oh, okay. Bush also quotes Woodward's writings almost word for word in places where Woodward writes, "The second option combined cruise missiles with manned bomber attacks." Bush says this: "The second option was to combine cruise missile strikes with manned bomber attacks." Ooh. And where the Woodward book says, "The third and most robust option was cruise missiles, bombers, and what the planners had taken to calling boots on the ground," Bush's book says, "The third and most aggressive option was to employ cruise missiles, bombers, and boots on the ground." borrowing? Is that what the Guardian UK calls borrowing? Bush manages to remember exactly the same shouts from people as Woodward from the crowd at Ground Zero after the 9/11 attacks, i.e., "Do not let me down," and "Whatever it takes," even though there must have been all sorts of shouts. Bush uses the two Bob Woodward uses. He borrows words, phrases, paragraphs, sentences. He borrows them. Oh, my.
From Decision Points, Bush's book, quoting John McCain in a manner that suggests he's talking to the then president. This is how Bush says, McCain said, I cannot guarantee success, but I can guarantee failure if we don't adopt this new strategy. And from an interview by McCain with the Washington Post in 2007, McCain said, I cannot guarantee success, but I can guarantee failure if we don't adopt this new strategy. Now, who is he talking? The second time he was talking to the Washington Post, who is he talking to the first time? El Presidente. President Guacamoron! Mr. Bush! Oh, my God. So anyway, all that just to let you know, maybe you had the same stomach-churning experience if you saw the Guacamoron on MSNBC over the weekend, interviewed by Matt Lauer, a rebroadcast of the exclusive interview that Matt Lauer had on NBC. Is there justice in this cold, heartless world? Apparently not. I'll see you tomorrow night. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.